Can have your attention. Let's call to order the third general session of the California Council of the Blind Spring Convention.
Yay!
To begin, we have Dr. Wally Amer to give us the invocation, and he's here from the SLAM Islamic Center of Sacramento.
Thank you. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Fellow members and supporters of California Council of the Blind, may the peace of God be with you, or in the Arabic Islamic salutation, Assalamu alaikum. This day, with a mission to fulfill, with a dream to realize, with hope to live for, with recognition to give, with compassion, with companionship to trust, with information to share, all these ingredients make this occasion divinely special. God is proud of us. His presence with us must be felt. We came here to be part of this spring convention, to celebrate our past, to be thankful for our present, and to look forward to our future. We came here to appreciate the work of California Council of the Blind, a service organization whose noble mission is to promote rights and services to its members. We came here to honor those who made a difference to the quality of life to our members. We came here to appreciate the programs and efforts of those who provided the services for those who are in need. What a befitting occasion to quote from the Quran, the revealed book of Islam, where God says, "Help one another in furthering virtue and God consciousness, and do not help one another in furthering evil and hate." In another verse, God says, "Work, for God shall behold your deed." The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, the Prophet of Islam, tells us the golden rule in Islam: you have no faith until you love to your fellows in humanity what you love to yourself. We are here today to do just that, to stand hand in hand, to care for each other, to work together to support our brothers and sisters who are in need. Let us pray. Almighty God, we are meeting here today as brothers and sisters in this human gathering. Bring us together, Almighty God, so we can understand and accept one another. Bring us together, Almighty God, so we can help whoever is in need. Help us, Almighty God, to see the many grounds we have in common and to set aside the differences that may separate us. Help us, Almighty God, to transcend all human barriers, to accept and work with each other for the good of our members. Give us, Almighty God, the courage to recognize right as right and help us to follow it, and to recognize wrong as wrong and help us to avoid it. Almighty God, we pray to bless this meeting, to bless those who organize it, to bless those who provide services for our members everywhere, and to bless the work of California Council of the Blind. In your name, the compassionate, the merciful. Amen.
Thank you so much. Now to present the Pledge of Allegiance, let me introduce to you Jeannie Ackerman from the San Mateo chapter of CCB. Jeannie?
Everyone stand. Hold your right hand over your heart and repeat after me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeannie. Before we begin the program you have in your agenda, we have a few items to slip in, committee reports that we need to take care of this afternoon. The first one is a report from the nominating committee, at which some of you were at last night, to present the decisions that were made at that time as the nominating committee chair. And I'll turn the floor over now to Rob Turner.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Hold on, Bob, for 1 second.
Thanks. Okay, thank you, Chris. So, as you'll remember, before the nominating committee met last night, we had two elections. Donna Pomerantz was elected to serve out Rhonda's term as second vice president. And then also, Linda Perrell was elected to fill the seat that was opened when Donna won the second vice president position. So we have the nominating slate is second vice president Donna Pomerantz, secretary Gabe Griffith. This would be his second term. Jerry Arakawa would be his fourth term. Peter Pardini, his second term. Now, new board members the nominees are Artis Basin, Foster Brown, and Linda Perrell. Thank you. And thank the committee for...
Thank you very much, Rob. Appreciate the report and your work on that committee. Has Jerry Kunstler come in the room?
Yes. Sir.
Very good. Jerry, how about a report from the Constitution and Bylaws Committee?
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. Delighted to be here with you. Jeff has asked me to make an announcement that tomorrow morning we will present a proposed amendment to the Constitution. It relates to Article 5 concerning meetings, the changing of a single word semi-annually to annually, and a vote will be taken this fall on this proposed amendment. And I don't know if you want to have discussion on it now, President Tom, or just I'm alerting you now that we will officially present this tomorrow morning for a vote this fall.
Jerry, thank you very much.
We'll
look forward to hearing from you tomorrow and whatever transpires after that. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Stuart Wittenstein is an experienced teacher and administrator in programs for children who are blind or visually impaired. He's worked hard in Texas, New York, New Jersey, and California, where he is now in his 13th year as the superintendent of the California School for the Blind. A strong advocate for Braille literacy, Dr. Wittenstein was the Braille teacher at the Texas School for the Blind and also taught Braille and Nemeth Code, the math code, courses in the teacher preparation programs of Hunter College, New York, and Teachers College, Columbus University. Dr. Wittenstein has a number of publications over the years, particularly in Braille literacy, and he is co-editor of Collaborative Assessment, Working with Students Who Are Blind or Visually Impaired, including those with additional disabilities, a textbook used in preparing teachers in this country. He is currently the chair of the Editorial Advisory Committee of the Journal of Visual Impairment and Blindness, a magazine which I think we probably all know at least something about, even if we don't read it. He's been the winner of a number of awards. He was past president of the Division on Visual Impairment for the Council of exceptional children. In 1994, he received the division's Outstanding Itinerant of the Year Award, and in 2006, he received the division's Distinguished Service Award. Dr. Wittenstein is current president of the Council of Schools for the Blind, a national organization of superintendents of special schools for blind learners. So it is indeed an honor to be addressed by a great educator, a great Californian, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Stuart Wittenstein.
And thank you, CCB, for inviting me to be here this afternoon. It's great to be with you to help you celebrate your 75th anniversary. You guys have so much to be proud of. This organization has done so much good for one another, for blind people all over this country. You were at the very beginning of the civil rights movement for people who are blind or visually impaired, and you're carrying that forward to this day. It's a remarkable legacy that you share. I read more about it in the Kathy Skiver's article in the Blind Californian just before. I'm always learning from Kathy, and she did a terrific job with that article. I hope you all got a chance to check it out. Today, my subject is to talk a little bit about Schools for the Blind, where they've been, where they're headed, and I am here representing Council of Schools for the Blind. I wanted to explain that briefly for you. The California Department of Education has a freeze on travel, so I'm not representing them today. And this trip is not costing the taxpayers a dime. Just wanted to be clear about that. As you know, the state budget, you know, is a real concern at the moment, and we've been asked to be very responsible in how we spend taxpayers' money, as we should always be. And anyway, just to be clear, they do have a process by which you can request an exemption from the travel freeze. But frankly, since you folks are nearby and it's a Saturday, I didn't ask for an exemption, so I just showed up here today. I was going to start with a bit of history. This is a great year to be talking about history. Your 75th anniversary, the 200th anniversary of the birth of Louis Braille. What better time to be talking about our history together? And I will talk some about the history of Schools for the Blind. But I kind of am going to interrupt my own presentation to tell you about something that I wrote yesterday. Because the Oregon state legislature in the coming weeks is going to be considering closing their School for the Blind. It seems they have a legislator who has decided that they don't need a School for the Blind, and she's written some amendments that would change their state's education code and result in the closing of the school as of this coming September. I've never visited the Oregon School for the Blind. My students have, because they go up there and play in goalball tournaments and karate tournaments, and they always host the stuff because they're not allowed to go anywhere, and so they ask us to go there, and we do that. So I haven't been there, but my understanding is, and this is my understanding may be incorrect, but my understanding is that Oregon had let the facility run down pretty and be in pretty bad shape, and they decided that the only way to that renovating that facility would cost too much money. So they were going to move the School for the Blind onto the School for the Deaf campus, where there was room, and they were going to upgrade that whole facility. And it seemed like maybe a doable solution. But now instead they're looking at closing it. So this is what I wrote yesterday to the committee, because I can't be there in person for the hearing they're going to have. And frankly, they're giving speakers only 2 minutes to really present present anything at this hearing, so I thought I would write something short enough to get in the 2 minutes and that they would go on the record with. I sent it to a member of their advisory board as well as to a staffer from the legislature, hoping that at least one of those versions would get in the record. This is what I wrote, and when I get finished with that, we'll talk about maybe what other steps we could be taking. April 3rd, 2009, wrote it yesterday. My name is Stuart Wittenstein. I'm the president of the Council of Schools for the Blind. Thank you for the opportunity to submit this written comment on the amendments to HB 2834 on behalf of the 45 member schools of COSB, Council of Schools for the Blind. The council commends the amendments for recognizing the need for the state to assume responsibility for children who are blind or visually impaired by creating a resource and outreach center. Due to the low prevalence nature of visual disabilities, local education agencies often do not have the experience nor the expertise to provide appropriate education for this low incidence population without the support from the state. Initiatives like this one have been successful in many other states. However, the council is gravely concerned that Oregon is considering closing its special school for children who are blind or visually impaired, including those with multiple disabilities. Such special schools are a necessary part of the service delivery system of over 40 states and ensure that children have a full array of service options from which to benefit. Children and families should have more choices for placement options, not fewer. Unfortunately, in an era of shrinking resources and research dominated by studies of high incidence disability populations, some individuals make the error of assuming that programming designed to meet the needs of high incidence populations will also meet the needs of those with sensory impairments. Research and program evaluations which study high incidence populations cannot be generalized to programs for children who are blind or visually impaired. Children with visual disabilities have very different educational needs, and for many of them, placement in a special school for the blind is the least restrictive environment. In addition, maintaining the special school option allows each state the flexibility to initiate a variety of programming to meet its needs, including providing short courses anywhere from 1 week to a semester to provide intensive instruction in blindness adaptation skills, which enable students to be more successful when they return to their home district for core curriculum coursework. Schools for the Blind offer a unique environment to provide intensive instruction as well as a social milieu needed by many students for their emotional growth and adjustment. Many blind children are terribly isolated in their home schools and often feel like the School for the Blind was the first placement in which they could thrive. The bottom line is the School for the Blind in the 21st century has a lot to offer its state, and if the Oregon School for the Blind is closed, it is the families and children who will lose a rich opportunity for learning and growing. The council stands ready to assist Oregon in making plans to strengthen its school. Please call on us should you desire to use our technical expertise and experience. Sincerely, Stuart Wittenstein, President. Unfortunately, some people, well, first of all, as somebody who's worked in Schools for the Blind for a long time, one thing we've always been worried about is if we ever had a sustained, sharp economic downturn, would states continue to support what's they consider to be an expensive program? And how would we combat this? But one of the things that's happened is there is a lot of research that says that kids with disabilities should be in inclusive settings and there shouldn't be any specialized settings. And they're talking about kids who are learning disabled or have behavior disorders which are the majority of the kids with disabilities in our school systems. And they're trying to use that same model with kids whose needs are so very, very different. And it's a basic mistake in research to try to apply one set of practices to a population on which the research wasn't based. And so I'm trying to get their attention about this, but I am concerned that one legislator can really start a whole wave of efforts like this. And let me just give you another point of view on this too, because just even the mention that they're going to close the School for the Blind can have a devastating effect. About 10 years ago, the Wisconsin state superintendent said, I think we ought to close the School for the Blind. And the consumer groups and the professionals banded together in parent groups. All, everybody got together and fought the state superintendent. And they won. They didn't close the school for the blind. But what happened was when he announced they were going to close the school, a lot of the staff from the school started looking for other jobs. And a lot of families started looking for other placements for their kids. And by the time the battle was over, the school was about a third of its size. So even the talk about this or the threat of it can be devastating to these programs. I would urge you all who might have contacts in a chapter, affiliated chapter in Oregon, to see what they're doing and what we can do to help. There will be some hearings next week. And that was why I got the writing done as quickly as I could. I think the hearing, the in-person hearing is on Tuesday.
Yes.
So there really isn't a whole lot of time or a whole lot of notice to get anything done. A terrible start with bad news, but this is the kind of thing that I know this organization has worked hard on. I know when California was looking for a new superintendent in 94, 95, 96, this organization and others stood up and explained to the California Department of Education what kind of a person, what kind of a background you thought they should be looking for when they hired somebody. And there were staff at the California School for the Blind who thought the school was going to close. And it was organizations like this that made a difference. And actually, Al Gill, is he here today? Al was on the interview committee interviewing superintendents. So you guys have been there, making sure that the Department of Ed heard from you about the value you place on this kind of programming. Matter of fact, Al, one of my favorite anecdotes is when it came time for Al to be asking me a question when I was applying to be superintendent. He had been taking notes all day on his slate and stylus, and his question was, "What do you think about the teaching of the slate and stylus?" So I kind of thought I knew what he wanted to hear, you know. Anyway, going back to history, this has been a great year for us to be looking at our history. And you heard that I'm involved with the Journal of Visual Impairment and Blindness. They're doing a neat thing this year, which is in each issue they're doing an article about Braille as a way to celebrate Louis Braille's birth. And they've asked me to write the history piece, which is strangely enough going to be at the end. You know, you would think history would be up front, but, you know, okay. So I've been doing a lot of research on the 1700s and 1800s in France and trying to figure out why the French were ready to start a school for the blind, what was making that happen, and why the world was ready for Louis Braille and his code when it happened. And we have such an interesting beginning there. There were some French philosophers, and they were the same guys whose words inspired people to start the French Revolution and the American Revolution, who started writing that everybody had the right to an education, that everybody had the right to fulfill their potential and live out their dreams and have equal access. And they weren't thinking about blind people. They were thinking about all people. But it was those sentiments that started people thinking that maybe that everybody means everybody, and everybody means even a class of people that we didn't used to educate. And that's why the first school for the blind started in France. By the way, that's why the first school for the deaf started in France about the same time. They were really forward thinking on that. And it was the school for the blind that made the Braille code possible, because before Louis Braille, there were other people who came up with literacy systems for themselves. But you know what? Those were lost over time because those folks were by themselves and didn't have anybody to share it with. Louis could share it with his fellow students. And even when the teachers and administrators at the school might not like the code, and as a matter of fact, they had one principal that that burned all the Braille and banned it from use. But it was the students who wouldn't let go of it. The students said, you know what? This may not be anything like print, but it works for us. It makes sense to us. And it, And if anything, they were the first consumer group who spoke out and said, we know what's right for us, and that this system is designed for tactile readers, and that's what we are. And without a school, though, and without that core group, Louis Braille might have created this system for himself, and it would have been lost after he passed away. So Schools for the Blind and Blind People in Literacy have that, if you will, affiliation and support for one another. Now, 75 years ago when this organization started, and I'm looking at my watch because I know we got a schedule to keep here, and I could talk for a long time on these subjects. You have heard that I was a university professor for a while. That means I could talk for 3 hours without much to say about anything, you know. We don't have that kind of time, unfortunately. 75 years ago when this organization started, there weren't any options for kids other than Schools for the Blind. Very few kids who are visually impaired were educated in public schools. And that's changed because a lot of kids have been able to access materials in education and to get quality in their public schools, and that's wonderful. You know, the first school for the blind in the United States was Perkins. Actually, there's some argument about that between Overbrook and Perkins and the New York Institute. They all kind of argue about which one started first, But the first director of Perkins was Samuel Gridley Howe, and Samuel Gridley Howe was outspoken on the fact that blind kids should be educated in public schools. Even though he ran a school for the blind, he thought, this isn't fair, that this is their only choice. And this goes back to the letter I wrote about Oregon. Closing the school is as bad as keeping everybody in the school. People need to have choices based on what their needs are and what their skills are and what their desires are for the kind of programming they want. And because of that, one of the things Schools for the Blind have been doing is instituting what we call short courses. We now have courses that go for a week or 2 weeks or a semester or a year. And because you're enrolled in the School for the Blind doesn't mean you're going to be there for 12 years and graduate from there. And so we have various options to meet the needs of a wide range of kids. We're doing things like bringing kids in to give them a week of intensive instruction to prepare them to pass the math section of the high school exit exam, which the math section is the part that seems to be the most difficult for our youngsters. And part of the reason for that is the tactile graphics. Try to read pie graphs and charts and gather the information that you have to. You know, it's so interesting. We should be holding our kids to high standards and the same standards as sighted kids. But when you think about it, if the whole world was blind, nobody would have ever invented a pie graph. I mean, a pie graph is to give sighted people information at a glance. For a blind person, it's much harder to grab the information out of there and make sense out of it. There are much better ways and easier ways for blind people to gather information. But you know what? It's a state standard, and if we want our kids to pass the state standards and pass the high school exit exam, they have to know how to do these things. And I'm not a big fan of a lot of the high-stakes testing, but one of the things that I do like is that it's made us focus on the need to teach more about how to read a graphic and to make sure that the graphics that the kids are getting are accurate and high quality and in good shape, too. So that's another thing that that Schools for the Blind are working on. I want to leave some time for questions. Let me tell you a little bit. I told you about that Braille, those Braille articles in the Journal of Visual Impairment and Blindness. Let me tell you one more thing. Those are free online. You don't have to be a subscriber to the journal, okay? So if you want them, you go to afb.org, because they're the folks who publish the journal, and find the journal, and you can find, there's a section called free content, and all that stuff is in there. So feel free to look for that, because they're giving that away. So, you know, we need to make sure to make use of it. Before I quit, I want to thank this organization over the years for your advice and support of me and my school. Several of the people in this room are constant advisors for me. They're on my community advisory committee. Joni Patchy, sitting right in front of me, is the chair of that committee. Elmer Chapson has, I don't think, ever missed a meeting. Leslie Tom is a regular at those meetings. Lynn Laird, Kathy Skivers was such a great mentor to me when I first came here to California. Wonderful lady. Al Gill shows up occasionally at those meetings, even though he's out of state now. And I can't tell you how important their advice, their wisdom, their experience has been to me about what works and what doesn't for blind people and keeping, keeping us on the right track, making sure we're doing the right thing for the kids and the families we serve. So I really do appreciate all that advice and support. And before I run out of time and I get the hook, I want to open it up in case folks have any questions they want to ask me.
We have time for maybe two very quick questions if you want to come to a microphone.
Good afternoon, Stuart Wittenstein. My name is David Jackson. Just a quick question. If one wanted to know more of an extensive history on blind schools, where could they go? What kinds of – is there a particular author or authors or indexes to look at? Thank you.
Thanks for the question. The best place online that I know right now is the New York Institute for Special Education in the Bronx. And their website is nyise.org. And they have a great history section. They got a great history section about Braille as well there. So it's nyise.org. And then eventually when I get finished doing my research on the French philosophers, you'll have my article hopefully on that AFB.org website, but it's not there yet.
Okay, any more questions? All right. Dr. Wittenstein, thank you so much. Lisa Lloyd has worked for Foundation Fighting Blindness, a research-driven nonprofit established in 1971, as their director of development for Northern California for 3 years. She opened their Northern California Sunnyvale office in 2007. She has a master's degree in counseling education from San Jose State, and a bachelor's in psychology from College of Notre Dame in Belmont, California. She also holds a certificate and associate's degree in adaptive fitness from Foothill College, specializing in work with the blind and visually impaired. She has X-linked retinitis pigmentosa, RP, and was diagnosed at the age of 22. Lisa has 5 other affected family members, a good reason to leave her career in education and join in the cause. She oversees 4 active Northern California Foundation Fighting Blindness chapters. Her father is a participant in the Second Sight Retinal Implant Human Clinical Trial that has given back some of his vision. Lisa's here today to talk to us a bit about the foundation and update us on clinical trials. And ladies and gentlemen, join me now in welcoming Lisa Lloyd.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much to CCB for having us be here today. Really appreciate it. Our urgent mission for the Foundation Fighting Blindness is to drive the research that will provide preventions, treatments, and cures for people that are affected by retinitis pigmentosa, RP, macular degeneration, MD, Usher syndrome, and the entire spectrum of retinal degenerative diseases. We are now considered the world's largest non-governmental source of funding for retinal degenerative disease research. Of course, back in 1971, when we first started, there was nothing going on in the way of research for people with these diseases. Our co-founders, Gordon Gund, and a local guy, Lou Kern, who started Quake Cleaners, got together with a bunch of others and decided they were going to do something about that. So they started Foundation Fighting Blindness. And after being in research labs for approximately 36 years, there was enough of a foundation for them to be able to do research in human clinical trials. So in 2007, we entered a very different era in terms of these diseases. In April of last year, some of you may have heard about this, throughout the news, throughout the world, we reported about a breakthrough we had with Leber's congenital amaurosis in the field of gene therapy. This disease affects approximately 3,000 Americans, and it's a rare form of retinitis pigmentosa. This trial was conducted at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and it involved three young adults who had virtually no vision, and it had them reading several lines on an eye chart and seeing in dimly lit settings thanks to an innovative gene therapy that replaced the defective gene that wasn't working with one that did. You may have heard about this. My family that lives in Australia heard about it the same day. The good news is that these folks have continued to be able to maintain the vision without continued treatment, and that treatment first occurred about a year and a half ago. So that's very, very positive. According to our chief of science, Dr. Stephen Rose, not only does gene replacement hold promise for LCA, Leber's congenital amaurosis, the same approach may be used to treat a whole variety of retinal diseases, including RP, Stargardt's disease, Usher syndrome, and age-related macular degeneration. Good question. I would say that it might be possible for many, many other diseases, things that are not even eye-related. So it was really a breakthrough on the front of medical science for a lot of folks. Since this trial's results have been released, there are two more trials that are having success that I want you to know about. For those that are affected with the dry form of age-related macular degeneration, and this affects approximately almost 10 million people. It's grown up a million in the 3 years that I've been with Foundation Fighting Blindness. There is a new treatment that's on the horizon. A company by the name of Neurotech USA Inc., has come up with an innovative encapsulated cell technology. It's a tiny capsule that's implanted into the eye, and it has showed very encouraging results. In a 51-person phase 2 clinical trial, the device stabilized vision in 96.3% of people who received a high dose of the treatment. So Neurotech plans to report the results for their phase 2 and phase 3 clinical studies for people with retinitis pigmentosa, Usher syndrome, and choroideremia at their annual meeting of the Association for Research in Vision and Ophthalmology, fondly referred to as ARVO, in the first week of May of this year. So I'm really looking forward to that for all of us. The Foundation Fighting Blindness has funded much of these preclinical and clinical work that led to the advancement of this promising treatment. And fortunately, we were able to rescue that company at a time when they were about to go out of business. So I'm very thankful for that. The last trial that I wanted to talk to you about is the Second Sight trial. It's one that's dear and near to my heart, as my father is in it. He is one of nine people that are in that trial, and some of you may have heard about this particular technology. It was on the Discovery Channel last year, and my father was interviewed in January by 60 Minutes, and they're doing a segment on it possibly this year. They're just trying to determine if the research has moved along far enough or if they should wait until this device is more developed. But it involves a pair of glasses with a camera on the front right above the nose, and then a retinal implant on the retina, and it also has an energy pack and a little computer that he wears around his neck. This is a trial that's being conducted for people with RP, but it's also designed for people with macular degeneration. And my guess is that will help people with other forms of vision loss as well. They will be doing a MD trial for Second Sight in Europe soon. So the implant is known as Argus 2, and there are a couple folks about that have the Argus 1, which was the first model that I believe had 16 electrodes. My dad's version has 60. Incidentally, there are some hold on a second. Sorry. My father's the only person in Northern California who has this particular retinal implant. There was another person in Benicia that had to have it removed due to complications. So you can see this is not perfect science. It is a work in progress. The impulses get sent from the camera to the retinal implant and then get converted into an electrical impulse that goes back to the brain for interpretation. So, of course, the brain is doing the interpreting. My father went from no light perception to being able to see some things. Some of the things that he can see are cars of certain colors and certain shapes. He can tell the researchers with about 85% accuracy which side of the shape has been removed, if it's a triangle or square. He's also been able to see people's eyes because they have high water content. He's able to see anything with high water content. He describes people's eyes as cat's eyes at night. And he often calls them stars. He sees flashes of light. Several months after the surgery, he was able to see my hand on a white piece of paper when I briefly took something out of his briefcase, which was astonishing for me because my dad went blind when I was 3 years old, and he was 36, and he lost most of his vision in about 6 months. So I was very startled, needless to say, when he said, "Oh, I saw your hand." So it was a very exciting time for us. In order to participate in this study, the trial participants have to have no light perception so that there's no vision that can be lost. They have to live within 100 miles of UCSF, where the study is being conducted, and they have to be available for 3.5-hour long testing sessions each week for 3 years. So you can see it's a real commitment to participate in this, in some of this research. He has to wear the glasses for a minimum of 8 hours per day. My dad's a little bit of an overachiever. He goes for 10 to 12 hours per day. He's a blind lawyer, and he's had his own practice for 26 years. So he doesn't wear the device in the courtroom. I think it kind of pisses off the judge, to be honest with you. It does make a beeping noise when a connection is lost, and that would disturb counsel as well. So anyway, he's definitely wearing it longer than everybody else. And as a result, he may be having a little bit more success than some of the other trial participants. But some of the trial participants who have been blind for a less amount of time are experiencing even better vision than my father. So he did have a repositioning surgery about a year after the implant was first input into his right eye. And that first was done July 10, 2007. And then in April, he had the repositioning surgery, probably due to the movement of this retinal implant, or possibly it wasn't inserted correctly the first time. He was recently on a global conference call with people in Switzerland, France, England, and throughout the United States who were also in the very same trial. And so they were able to talk about what was working and what needed to be improved upon, which I was very happy to hear about. As you can imagine, it's very isolating participating in some of this research, so it's great to talk to others who are similarly affected. But in Dad's case, you know, his brain has to learn how to see again, and after 20 years of not being able to see images, it can certainly take a while. And he's been very patient. I have to say his attitude has definitely changed. He's a lot more positive and upbeat than what he was before in a lot of different ways. But I think he feels that, you know, he's had an opportunity to help advance science. And he was a biochemist before then and a computer programmer before he was a lawyer. So he kind of intimately understands the technology and how it can best be used in his own eyes. So I thank him for being a brave pioneer. I thank all of you who participated. Thank you. I thank all of you who've participated in the research in order to help things move forward. I think the future generations coming up in my family who are affected have a lot of hope. I also think that the current generation also has a lot of hope. I know my dream was that my dad would be able to see me again, and I was shocked that my dream is slowly coming true. The human clinical trials, unfortunately, are very, very expensive comparatively to research done in a lab for all those years. It costs $3 to $4 million for each one of these trials. So we do spend a lot of our time at Foundation Fighting Blindness trying to fundraise in order to bring in those kinds of dollars. We're doing a Dine in the Dark in San Francisco that has raised $450,000 towards research this April. Our goal is $500,000, and we're going to do it. But the costs have not stopped us in leaving no stone unturned with this research. I recently learned that at the ARVO conference, which is one of the largest ophthalmology conferences in the world, this May, Foundation Fighting Blindness, or FFB, has funded 225 of the projects that will be presented there, which is roughly 75% of the research that's being covered at the conference. So while this research is being conducted, there are people like myself who are waiting for a cure, and we know this. So we have offered chapters in the last 3 years, regional chapters, and we currently have 54 throughout the United States. These chapters are opportunities for people who are similarly affected to connect with one another, to connect with service organizations in the area, as well as to fundraise. And so I have one event coming up in Sacramento that I wanted to share for those of you who are local, and I have our Vision Walk chair, Judith Leach, with me to briefly let you know about that event, and she can share why she's involved. Thank you.
Well, I'm very happy to be here and see so many of you here this afternoon, because it's important to see what's out there for the visually impaired. And this is a wonderful conference with a lot of information. So I'm here to talk about the Vision Walk. The Vision Walk is for the retinal diseases, retinitis pigmentosa, macular degeneration, Stargardt's, and Usher syndrome, and that are affecting 10 million people in the United States. So among the 10 million that are affected are my two sons. They both have Usher syndrome, which is the severest form of the retinal diseases, which is the hearing loss and the blindness. So when my sons were first diagnosed, there was we went in there, my older son, and the doctor said, there is no hope, there is no cure. And so that, as a parent, is as devastating, and devastating to all of you who have had to deal with anything like that, and family members as well. Knowing that nothing could be done for my sons, and watching my older son go blind, and now watching my younger one as well, is... has been very difficult. But the research that has come out in the last few years has made my heart sore, because not only for the retinal diseases, when they find a cure for one of these things, it's connected to another one. So no matter what your form of visual loss is, something that comes up in one of the cures is going to affect the other one. And so the money for this research is so important. So we're doing these walks. This last year was the first walk in Sacramento, and this year will be the second one. And so we're hoping to raise more and more money. $3 or $4 million a clinical trial is a lot, but like Usher syndrome, they may be doing trials for on humans in 2 years. So that's pretty incredible. So the walk will be May 30th, and so I encourage everyone, if you talk to your family, your friends, all of you who are affected, we'd love to have you come out and walk with us. It's a wonderful and heartwarming and exciting event. You know, I can tell you that the money for this research is beyond important, okay, because it's going to affect all of you here who have visual loss, no matter what cure they come up with. So anyway, I hope you'll join with me in joining the Vision Walk May 30th. It's in Southland Park in Sacramento, and I know that I love my sons very much, and I want them to have a full life and a happy life. But if their sight can be restored along with so many others, I know that I won't stop until there's on this quest for a cure. So please come out and help us with this walk, and help to raise the funds for this retinal research for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're now going to move to a panel to tell us about something rather near and dear to my heart, something that Jeff was involved in, myself, others in California, and people all around the western part of the United States. If I start talking about it, I might not stop. So I'm going to just introduce this panel to tell you about the Western Leadership Conference, to give a report. And we haven't rehearsed and gone over this, but I think the way I'd like to handle it, if it's all right with the panelists, would be to introduce Linda Perrell. And Linda, if you're agreeable, I'll let you handle the proceedings from then on for your part of the agenda.
Thank you, Chris. Can you hear me now in the back?
You see, I'm thrusting you into leadership whether you want to or
right.
not.
That conference was called Taking the Reins of Leadership. So here we go. I was privileged, along with my two cohorts here, Foster Brown and John Ross, to be chosen by Jeff to attend the Western Regional Leadership Conference, which was held in Vancouver, Washington, over the Halloween weekend of 2008. John is our first speaker. He's going to review quickly the events of the weekend and speak about fundraising, which Dina Wilson from the National Office came to speak to us about that. Foster is going to present about publicity, and I'm going to present at the end about mentoring and ask you folks a couple of questions at the end. And since we're on, you should put your Victor Reader stream in fast mode, because we only have 20 minutes and we're going to be speeding this up. So here we go. Here's Sean.
Okay, everyone. Thanks for having us. First, an overview of what was talked about that weekend. On Saturday, we talked about advocacy efforts, legislative policy making, and all that's involved, constitution and bylaws and how those are drafted, resolutions, value of ACB inventions, membership development, and why it's important. PR, public relations, fundraising, and after it was all said and done, we broke up into small groups and worked on different events. One corps had to plan a convention. One group had to put together a PR, and one had to come up with a fundraiser. And that was an overview of the weekend. As far as fundraising, they report that Dina Wilson gave us. I'm going to review it quickly. Okay. First off, the objectives of the report were to review the basic tenets of fundraising, to understand the art of how to ask, cost effectiveness of fundraising, and develop an annual fundraising plan, as well as ways of evaluating your fundraising. Those were the basic objectives. fund development versus fundraising. Nina explained that a fund development is an ongoing process, whereas fundraising is asking for a gift. Tenets of fund development. First, why do people give? For service and for relationships. Second, mission is everything. People want to know what you're about before they give. Giving is an emotional event. Donors are friends and advocates. And you have to build a trusting relationships with your donors. What is the number one reason that people don't give? Answer, they aren't asked. Age and giving. The greatest amount of wealth lies with the Americans near or at retirement age. Tips for success for successful asking. Do your homework. Know who your donors are. Relate your mission to your donors' interest. Find volunteers who have given before. Ask for a specific amount. And finally, let the donor do the talking. And to wrap up, evaluate your fundraising effectiveness. Match your goals with your appropriate method. Assess benefit of activities. And lastly, balance the three above. And that's an overview of the fundraising presentation. And I'll pass it on to Linda.
Okay. Another one of the things covered during the leadership conference was public relations, which essentially is our version of marketing. So mostly we rely on public relations and publicity. Excuse me. Two forms of this are public service announcements and press releases. Then one of the key things with PR is determining who your audience is. So our audience is, you know, the blind sector of our society, which includes those that are already blind, the newly blind, and those who are starting to lose their vision. And also, you want to attract the friends and relatives of these people as well. And with those that are newly blind or those that are losing their sight, you know, it's important to reach them because they may be confused. You know, they don't understand what's going on. You know, they don't know who to turn to, you know, to get answers and to get support and whatnot. So the purpose of us doing this is to let the public know who we are and that we are and that we provide services for the blind and the visually impaired community. Okay. Just like with marketing, we have target groups. So, as I mentioned, the first group is the newly blind. Well, that's one group. Then another group are those that are losing their vision. And then another group is those that have already lost their vision, and also their friends and family. Another group you can target, which is also an asset to your public relations, would be eye doctors and eye specialists. Because if you leave information in the doctor's office about your local CCB chapter, about CCB in general, you know, your doctor, you know, may give that information to someone so that they know what services are out there to help them by referring them to CCB. And it'll give that person some place to turn to. Another place, educational institutions. So with that, we can speak at schools, and we can also hold information seminars and various things. And one of the big things, as far as college and universities are concerned, are you can give press releases to the Department of Student Services so that they can get those out to blind students. And one of a big one, especially with this generation, being that we're in a generation of a lot of communication, is to have tech shows. So if you could set up a technology show at a university, that would draw a lot of students in, and you know, that would also get our name out there as well. Some of the different media that we can use are the internet, TV, newspaper, and we can also use the radio. And one of the objects, one of the things when we do these public service announcements, press releases, is that we want it to be free, or as little cost as possible. So one way is through public service announcements that can be done on the radio. And you may be able to get a free spot that's about 30 seconds. So then you have about 70 or 80 words. So you really have to make your message, you know, get to the point, and, you know, let people know what's available. Also, with public relations, people, it's just like when you look at a TV commercial. You may hear a TV commercial for a Maytag refrigerator, but you might not need one at the time. But there may come a time in the future when you need a refrigerator. So same way, there may come a time when a person may lose their sight for whatever reason, through disease, through some type of accident. And if our information is constantly out there, it may come back to their remembrance where they saw that ad or where they heard the ad. Did they hear it on TV, or did they, you know, see it posting up on a college campus or something like that? So it's important to do the public relations, because that will pull people in, you know. And it just depends on if that person needs it. They might not need it themselves, but they might know someone else who needs it. So it's important to have those types of things out there. Another aspect, as far as doing video, audio is a little easier to do because we could actually, you know, do our own podcast. But if you check into your local public broadcasting service, sometimes these are stations are operated through colleges and universities. So you may be able to get a free spot there, and they'll actually help you with all the video setup, the music, the lighting, the background, and whatnot. So there are ways to get the message out there and also be, you know, cost effective. The last thing is some of this information can actually be found on the AC website. It's called a Press Release Handbook for ACB Chapters and Affiliates. And that's available, and it's a free download. I think it's in a PDF format. So As with regular businesses, the public may not need our services, but possibly in the future. Pumping out press releases on a regular basis is an excellent way to reach public for a grassroots organization such as CCB.
Thank you, Foster and John. I'm really glad that at the last two conventions, we've added a new segment of remembering those that have gone on from this world. It gives us the opportunity to remember them and to identify their sterling qualities that we might want to emulate. We can never hope to be their replacements, but we can strive to be their successors. So today I want to talk a little bit about succession planning. And no, that's not about finding the right Austro-Hungarian princess to bear the next heir to the British throne. That's about planning for the leadership of CCB for the future. Succession planning can go on an ongoing basis, and a key factor in succession planning and the success of it is mentoring. Last night during the president's dinner, I heard a lament on and off throughout the sharing around the room was, we have the same people doing the same work all the time in our chapters, be it fundraising or any other activities of the chapter. It's always the same folks. Well, I'm going to ask you, I'm going to challenge you to go back to your chapters and go home and look at the situation with fresh eyes. And I want to give you some guidelines to think about how to assess your situation to increase chapter involvement. First of all, I want to urge, and this is for people who are potential mentors and people who are potential mentees. Not that I like that word, but there it is. So you go home, you go to your chapter meeting, you observe. You observe what people are excited, what an individual is excited about when a topic comes up. Say something about transportation in your town, and that person gets very animated during that discussion. Or say it's just about planning food for the next meeting, and that person gets pretty animated about which restaurant you're going to be eating at, or whatever it is. There is something that floats everybody's boat, and it's your responsibility as a chapter leader or as a member, to sort of observe that and make note of it. And once you sort of have some ideas and you say, oh, well, you know, Susie over there is really, really interested in that issue of pedestrian safety. Maybe I should think about inviting her to attend, you know, the citywide committee on this issue. So then we move to the invitation stage. Okay, now when you invite somebody to do something, sometimes they're going to say, oh, you know, I'm going to have surgery in about a week and a half, and, oh, you know, my daughter is coming in from out of town, or, you know, I'm way too busy with my job. We all have lives. CZB is a very important part of our lives, but it's not all of it. So make note of that and say, that's fine, but I'm going to ask you again because I think you have something to offer. And by indicating that, you've kind of planted a seed. They go home and say, oh, Linda thinks I have something to offer. And they think, well, gee, you know, maybe I have that Thursday afternoon free that committee meets. Maybe I could think about doing that. It may take time. It may take a month or two or three. It may take assigning somebody else to the job, and then the original person says, well, they're doing it. I'd like to go along and do it as well. But You need to keep inviting people. And on the mentee side, you need to come up and volunteer and not be afraid and say, well, I'd really like to take a shot at running this fundraiser. I'll tell you an example I have for myself. I came to San Francisco chapter in the fall of 2005, and in February of 2006, they had an employment seminar on a Saturday at the Lighthouse. And I just, Winifred was the president, Winifred Downing, and I said, I'd like to MC that. And she said, well, go ahead. And I have to tell you that I think that my emceeing that day sort of clicked in people's mind that, hey, this woman has something to offer. And I think that you know, planted a seed that led to my being elected president. I don't know what my chapter people would say, but I think it started that day. So step up to the plate and offer to do something and shine. Show your talents. Then the issue becomes a little later on. Okay. I'm in a significant subgroup of human beings that the rest of you might refer to only in the kindest way, of course, as control freaks. We like to do things our way. We know the right way to do things. We know when to get them done. We know how they should be done. So it's downright scary to delegate and say, oh, that slacker over there, they're really going to get this done. But it's important in succession planning and mentoring and developing new leadership to delegate and to let that person do it their way. Get the job done. It may be a little different than you get it done. It may be a little closer to the deadline that you're comfortable with. But if it gets done, and if it gets done well, that is a feather in your cap as well as theirs. And you will have worked really hard to develop the new leaders for CCB. So I'm inviting all of you to go home and think about these chapter members that just kind of sit around in a new light and see if you can find things for them to do, invite them to do them. And even if you get one or two more involved than you had last year, you're further down the road to your own retirement. I mean, I just got reelected president, and it struck me, oh, no, I'm not going to be el jefe por la vida. You know, there's going to come a time when I'm not the president anymore. Well, that time will come soon, and I better have somebody prepared to move things forward at that time. So I'm inviting you all to think in those terms, because we really have another 75 years ahead of us. No, none of us in this room are going to be there, but it's our job to make sure that somebody is. And now, in closing, I would like to ask you folks if we are interested and available to continue to share what we learned and, you know, other aspects of the leadership conference. I guess they're going to be trying to do them in other areas of the country, and they might swing around and do another one here at some point. But here we are. We got this training. We want to use it. We want to flex our muscles for the good of CCB. So I'm offering two possibilities. One is that we think about a Thursday morning seminar like the one that was done a couple years ago for presidents and officers, and the writers one this year, maybe to be done at our spring convention next year. Also, I think I can speak for my two guys here and say that we'd all be willing to visit local chapters in our region and discuss these issues more in depth with you if you folks would be interested in any of those activities. So, thank you.
Panel, thank you very much. Once again, Linda Perrell, John Ross, and Foster Brown. We're going to slip a program item in right now that we were going to do yesterday, but the history committee got carried away, or you got carried away with us. I don't know which way it went, but we did not have a report from Frank Welty, our director of legislative affairs. I'm going to ask Frank to give us his report now for about 15 minutes, and we'll see how the time goes. We may have time for questions, we may not. Anyway, for his debut convention report to CCB, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Welty.
Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Credentials Committee, sorry, wrong hat. I'm delighted to be here in this new position, wearing some very oversized shoes as your new Director of Advocacy and Governmental Affairs. And I think it's going to take me a while to fully fill the shoes that I've inherited, but I'm going to do my best. I want to warn you, though, that something that you're going to want to know about me from now on. Whenever you see my name on the convention program, that's a signal to me, to you, that you're going to want to be prepared to take notes in your method of choice. That's a warning. And yes, there will be a midterm. So, class, pull out your notebooks and let's get started.
Very good. Don't worry. I go real fast. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. First off,
however it turns out,
I want to start with a big thank you. On Thursday morning, we had a Capital Day event, and we had over 24 CCB members get involved, going up to the Capitol, visiting offices, and spreading the good word. And you guys did a great job. We had a number of new folks there, and just what I got from everybody was that they just were fired up and had a great experience and learned a lot, and I'm just delighted that I had the chance to be a part of that. I'm looking forward to doing that in future years, and it'll be bigger and better. So thank you for those of you that came this year. Please come back and bring your friends. Now, there's some other things that I plan to be doing here in the near future. Of course, I'm going to be doing capital advocacy, trying to keep track of those bills in the legislature, knocking on doors up there in the Capitol, making appointments, trying to get votes lined up, all that good stuff. I'm going to do that. But also, I want to be a resource to all of you throughout the state. I hope that every chapter will have an operational governmental affairs committee, and I want to do everything I can to make that happen. You know, whether you have such a committee yet or not, I want to be a resource. I want to be a mentor. I know it can be a scary thing to get something like that started. I want to do everything I can to help you make that happen in any way I can. I also want to do what I can to give you frequent legislative reports via the California Connection, by updates on our phone system, and of course by articles in the Blind Californian, so that I can share with you as much information about what's going on in state legislation and other issues as well. I've also been assigned to be a liaison to the state government that's working on emergency preparedness planning and incorporating the concerns of people with disabilities in that area. And I've been assigned, along with others in CCB, to be an interface with the blind community to the state agencies that deal with that issue. And there are other advocacy issues that I'm going to be working on and trying to figure out how to find the time to do that. One thing that I look forward to doing is raising an army of CCB advocates around the state of California. You know, folks, this is population-wise by far the biggest state in the United States. I think we have more than 10% of the entire U.S. population, and ain't no way one guy is going to get done everything that needs to get done in the area of advocacy and governmental affairs. So I need all of you to do your part, whatever that part is that's appropriate for you. And I want to share a few ideas on how you can start doing that today. First off, as I just mentioned a moment ago, I want to encourage every chapter to start, revitalize, or strengthen your Legislative Affairs Committee. And I'm going to do what I can to help that. I do have a list of chapter presidents, and I will be making phone calls to help encourage you and, you know, give you ideas and maybe sometimes a kick where it needs, you need to be kicked to keep things going if necessary. Don't worry, though, I won't wear heavy shoes when I do that. The second thing, and this is for everybody here, and this is where the test comes in. If you know, I want you to do this. Get ready to clap your hands if. Do you know who your state assembly member is? Clap your hands. Do you know who your state, notice I said state, not U.S. federal, state senator is? Do you know who your U.S. Congress member is? Okay, we got a few more. Do you know who your U.S. senator is? Okay, I challenge every one of you to learn that information because that is a really fundamental thing that you need to know. After all, you're a voter, and you ought, if you're going to be a smart voter, you need to know who these people are so you can pay attention to what they're doing between the 2 years when they ask you for your vote, right? Not to mention that if you want to talk to them, you'd better know who they are and where they live so you can find them, right? As it were. So, fortunately, it's actually pretty easy to get that information if you don't already have it. For those of you that are computer literate, there are three websites you want to know about. One is for the State Assembly, and it's, and all of these start with the www, it's assembly.ca for California, .gov. And when you get to that website, there's a link there that says something like Find Your District. You follow that link and a little form comes up that lets you type in your address and then it brings up a page that says, this guy is your senator and this woman is your assembly person. And it has their address and phone number and a link to their web page. So this is, you know, so that tells you what you need to know about them. And one of the important things you want to know is your district number. For example, are you in the 8th Assembly District like Assemblywoman Yamada tonight? Or are you in the 16th District like I am? Or whatever. It helps you to know that number because a lot of times when we talk about legislation, you hear references to the district. Another website that's really good, the one for the State Senate, is senate.ca.gov. And a third website that you want to know about is for the federal government, and that's house.gov, as in the House of Representatives. And on that page, on the House of Representatives website, there is a link to a page, the link is something like Find Your Representative. And it's kind of similar to that Find Your District thing on the state one, where you go to this screen where it asks you for your address, and then it'll show you who your congressperson is. And so that easily, if you're a computer person, you can get the information you know to contact your member of the legislature, whether it's the state legislature or the national legislature, whenever you need to do that. And believe me, I will be telling you when you need to do that. So be prepared because it's going to happen soon and it's going to happen often. Now, if you're not a computer geek, fear not. What you'll want to do there is contact your county elections department or maybe the registrar of voters. But you can get that from information. You know, call information, ask for the county elections department, and then call them and tell them that you want to find out what your district is, what your assembly district, your state senate district, and your congressional district is. And while you're at it, if you're in a local government where your county board of supervisors and your city government has districts, find that out too so you can keep track of those people. Because after all, the city council member today that you get to know may be the senator in 20 years that starts a piece of landmark rehabilitation legislation that changes the life of the blind in 20 years. Keep that in mind. And again, as I mentioned that, you know, it is important for you to start making efforts to connect with your government representatives. You know, it's not just about voting. It's about writing letters. It's about making phone calls. Find out when they're going to be out, you know, back in town, like if when they're going to be having a town hall meeting, and get in the habit of attending those. My friend Steve Fort in Alameda is really good about going to the meetings of Congressman Pete Stark. And guess who it was, and thanks to Kathy Skivers as well, guess who it was who carried a piece of legislation for us having to do with accessible currency? You think that would have happened, say, if Kathy Skivers and Steve Fort hadn't made the effort to make contact with Pete Stark for years before this ever came up? That's right, folks. You want your Congress member to do stuff for you 2 years from now. You need to start now to getting connected with them. And the same goes with your state legislature, your county supervisors, and your people in City Hall. And it's doable. You don't have to be a rich fat cat. It's just mainly showing up and letting them see your face and shake your hand. You know, most of these people are people. Most of these people that are in politics are really into people and talking to people and meeting people, because if they weren't, they probably would be engineers. Now let me get into the boring stuff. I want to talk about specific legislation that we're looking at right now. First, let me reiterate what Eric Bridges talked about last night, that there are two main pieces of federal legislation that we're dealing with. It's the things that we talked about back in February during the Washington seminar when you sent our group of Californians out there to lobby with Congress. The first one is a bill called H.R. 734, and the authors of that are two guys. One is named Towns and the other one is named Stearns. One, you know, Towns from New York and Stearns from Florida. That's the Pedestrian Safety Enhancement Act of 2009. That's the bill that would require the U.S. Transportation Department to do a study on quiet cars, come up with a standard for the minimum noise that those cars should be putting out, and make that required for new cars that are produced in a couple of years. That is H.R. 734. And here's the deal there. So far, we've got 11 California Congress members who have signed on as co-sponsors, 105 throughout the country. We want more. And I want to do some specifics right now. Is there anybody here who's in Henry Waxman's district? Anybody here?
God help me.
Does anybody here? Did I hear somebody in the back?
I used to be.
You used to be. Do you know somebody who's still in Henry Waxman's district? Good. Tell them to contact Henry Waxman's office and ask him to become a co-sponsor of this legislation. And for those of you throughout California, please contact your member of Congress. I have notified folks who are listening to the CCB email, who are on the CCB email list, the names of those people who have already signed on as co-sponsors. But that's only 11. There's another 42 that haven't signed on yet. So there's great opportunity. And we want to do this because we want to get the momentum going behind this bill. The second one piece of legislation that hasn't come out yet, but we're hoping to this summer, is the 21st Century Communication and Video Accessibility Act. Did I get that right? I think so. That's the one that has to do with making the emergency information on TV accessible, that has to do with restoring video description, making cell phones accessible, a lot of cool stuff that we want to have happen. Keep an eye out for that. We'll let you know when that comes out and when they're going to be start to look for co-sponsors. So when that happens, you're going to, again, want to call your congressperson and tell them to sign on. It does not have a number yet. It has not been reintroduced. It was introduced last year. It didn't make make it through, so they're going to try and do it again sometime during this Congress, but it hasn't happened yet. But we're keeping an eye out for it. That's what's going on at the federal level. At the state level, there were three items that we focused in on during Capitol Day. And those three items are as follows. The first one is a response to this whole budget crisis, budget thing that they just came up with in February. And the problem there is that in order to come close, kind of sort of, to balancing the budget, the folks in the Capitol decided that they were going to make cuts in SSI payments, 2.3%, cuts in what they call optional Medi-Cal services. Optional doesn't mean that you don't really need them. It just means that the states can decide whether or not to fund them. And optional things include adult dental care, as if that's optional, or for those, for you diabetics out there, podiatric services, optional. Yeah, right. And also there are several other things that are of very importance that they're cutting. And the for example, they're limiting how much the state will reimburse counties for the wages of in-home supportive service workers to $9.50 an hour. So, and here's the problem: those cuts are falling on people who have nothing to cut.
Yes.
So let's see, here's the deal. We're saying that we're going to have those cuts on people who don't have anything to cut so that some guy can save a few cents in gas tax on his Beamer. I think there's a little disconnect there, and we tried to get that message to the legislature, because what's going to have to happen is, even though they made this deal in February, it's still up in the air. They're going to have that election on May 19th with those six controversial initiatives. They may or may not fail. Even if they do pass, there's talk now that the budget deficit in the next couple of years will still be $8 billion. So the bottom line is, there's still going to be negotiation and horse trading. And that's an opportunity for us to let our legislators know that they need to rethink cuts in these critical areas like SSI and Medi-Cal, because there has got to be a better place to find money than that. And we need to tell our people that. The second thing that we told them is getting right back to the quiet car issue. You may remember that last year we had a bill, SB 1174, by State Senator Alan Lowenthal, and that was a bill that would have called on one of the state committees here in California to do a study of quiet cars. It passed the legislature, woohoo! But Arnold didn't think we needed to do that here in California. Because he felt it was a federal issue. And you know, there's a legitimate argument that can be made about that. Well, that's where H.R. 734 comes in. That's obviously the next logical step, given that we couldn't get that done here in California. So we have asked Senator Lowenthal to sponsor a resolution that would put the state legislature on record in support of H.R. 734, given that they've already come out in support of the concept of doing something about quiet cars. That resolution got a number this week. It's SJR6. I think that stands for Senate Joint Resolution 6. So let your state legislators know that there is this piece, this resolution called SJR6, that is encouraging the state legislature to support, to be on record in support of this federal legislation that will do something about quiet cars, and remind them that this don't cost the state of California nothing. They like that. The third item that we're dealing with is a result of a resolution that we did last fall. That was a resolution we had having to do with the way state regulations are formatted when they're printed. Right now, when a state-led piece of state regulation is going to be changed and they publish what those changes are going to be, they do so typographically by saying that, for example, if something's being deleted, they show it in strikeout type. If something's being changed, they show it in italic type. Try getting your screen reader to tell you that when you're reading that change regulation, right? Not a good thing. We want to have the option of being able to get that information in a narrative form so that the text actually says, this paragraph is going to be deleted and we're going to change this sentence. That's what we want. We did have a bill drafted to do that, but unfortunately there was a deadline regarding when bills could be submitted, so we weren't able to get a member of the legislature to sponsor it before that deadline. But we're looking for other possible vehicles, perhaps amending an existing piece of legislation that's going through the legislature right now that might cover that. And so we'll keep you posted on that as time goes along. Pardon me while I clear my throat here a little bit. I'm going to run real fast in just a couple of minutes over some other bills that we've got an eye on, and then I'm going to let you go. So let me do this here. There's a bill that's AB 378. That is by Assemblymember Cook. That deals with establishing the training standards for IHSS workers. We're planning to support that. Then there is AB 386 by Ira Ruskin. This is a bill that would expand the accessibility of college educational materials, and it's mainly focusing on closed captioning. We support this, but we're hoping that we can maybe get an amendment in there that would include some language about description as well. And then there's SB 246, that's by Senator John Benoit, and that would call for background checks on people applying to be IHSS workers. We think that's a pretty good idea. And then there's some other bills that we're watching, but we haven't taken a position on at this point. One is AB 23 by Assemblymember Jones. That would be a universal health coverage bill. We haven't seen the details of that yet, but we're going to keep an eye out on that. AB 23. And then there's AB 452 by Assemblywoman Yamada, who will be here tonight, of course. And excuse me, I'm tail end of a cold. We've got it has to deal another bill having to do with in-home supportive service workers. It would allow people who are not currently eligible to receive those services to pay for access to the state's registry of IHSS workers, so that, in other words, so that if you need those services but you're not eligible currently to receive them, you would have the option of being able to pay for that service, to go out and purchase that service. And we don't have a position on it. I personally think it's a good idea, but we don't have a position on it at this point. But we are keeping an eye on that. The next one is another bill about in-home supportive services. It's AB 1532 and Assemblymember Liu. We don't have the details about that yet, but we'll keep an eye on that one. And then we have one, it's SB 92 by Onestad. This is supposed to be a health care reform piece of legislation. It has two things that it seems to do. One is that it would be establishing the use of electronic health records and billing records. And it would also try to do a demonstration program that would turn Medi-Cal service from what's called a defined benefit plan, where you have a list of certain benefits regardless of their costs that are covered, to what they call a defined compensation plan. It's sort of like the equivalent of going from a retirement plan to a 401k plan, where you would be guaranteed, instead of a certain amount of services, a certain amount of money that you could spend for services. And so the argument there is that it's more flexible, but of course some people would argue that then if the services you really need are more expensive, you might not be able to pay for them. We'll keep an eye on that, but that we don't know what's going to happen with that, and that's all I can say about that at this point. That was SB 92. One that I just heard about recently is SB 144. I haven't seen the details of that yet. It's by Fiona Ma, and it would increase the fines for violations of the use of parking placards. Yeah. Another bill is SB 250 by Flores. This is a law that would make spaying and neutering of cats and dogs mandatory. The one problem we have is we're not sure if it has language exempting service animal breeding. You know, we don't want to decimate our service animal colony, so we have to keep an eye on that to make sure that Guide Dogs for the Blind can still get their dogs. And then there's something called SB 755 by Negrete McLeod. That's a Senator Negrete McLeod, and that has to do with promoting state contracts with persons with developmental disabilities business enterprises. In other words, just as we have the requirements that the state do business with Randolph Shepherd vendors, there are requirements that state contracts should be given to agencies that either are run by or employ people with developmental disabilities. And this has to do with promoting more of that. And we're keeping an eye on that. We don't have a position on it. It would be nice if we had something like that for blind people. But I just thought I'd let you know about that. And then on the Senate side, SB 810 by Senator Leno is another universal health care bill. So that's another one we're watching. And then there's one more that we're watching, and this is the last thing I'm going to mention. And we don't have a position on it because we're looking for guidance from the guide dog users. And that is SB 475 by Senator Padilla. And that is a bill that would allow the guide dog board to increase the amount of registration fees that they require, that the guide dog schools would be required to pay to support the guide dog board. Currently, the statute says that they can charge 0.004% of the guide dog school's cost for their annual fee. This would allow them to go as high as 0.005, but the actual amount would be set by the committee. And I've been told that what they're actually looking at present would be 0.00425. As we don't have a position on that, and we're going to have to see what the guide dog community feels about that. And so we're looking forward to hearing from you guide dog users on that issue. Those are the issues that we're looking at. Those are the ones that we're advocating on. I'm excited to be here. I hope I haven't taken too much time or bored you to death. And I want to thank the many of you who have expressed support for my coming to this position, and I look forward to working with lots of you and creating an army of CCB advocates throughout the state of California.
Frank Welty, thank you very much, and I would say that our support is pretty well placed based on your report. Thank you. Our next presentation is on the Department of Rehabilitation in budgetary hard times. 2 weeks ago, Marvelena and I were at the Hawaii Association of the Blind meeting, where we heard about the amazing shortfalls in revenue in Hawaii. It was so bad in Hawaii that I'm almost afraid to hear what we're going to hear in California. We have listed on the program Anthony Sowers, and formally speaking, Anthony Candela, Only Tony Candela could make it today. Tony's a great friend of CCB, and I know that he can tell us everything that we need to know this afternoon. We may even have a couple of moments for a question at the end. Without any further ado, I'll turn this over to Tony Candela to give us information about the budget and whatever else he wants to talk about. Tony?
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
No.
Let's see. All right, I've got the mic. Ah, I see. You have to get real close. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Chris and Jeff and all of you who have preceded me. You've given me, as is my habit when I come here, I try to catch as many points that other speakers have made that I think I might have a very quick comment on. So I'm going to begin with Frank Welty. His last bill, SB 475, goes to one of my other hats. My main hat is Deputy Director of Specialized Services inside the Department of Rehabilitation, and the Specialized Services Division is the one that houses all of the blindness programs that the DOR does. I have another hat. I'm the DOR designee to the State Guide Dog Board. So if I thought that DOR politics weren't enough excitement for me, I have like this other set of things that I can now get myself even into more trouble with. So when the two converge is when I think I need to go back to New York where I came from. But so far I'm still alive, and hoping nobody in the audience has tomatoes to throw today. SB 475, we have some movement on that. I will let the Guide Dog Users Group of California tell you what that movement is with regard to whether CCB will support SB 475, which has to do with the financial surviving of the Guide Dog Board as an independent board, a board that exists through the funds it raises as opposed to taking money from the state general fund. Since my main talk today is about budgetary hard times, the first thing that you need to know is if you say the words state general fund in any state in this country right now, California being a large example of the same, but if you say those words, state general fund, usually you get shudders of fear and cringing and weeping and gnashing of teeth, things like that, because that's what every state calls the main budget that it operates under, is the general fund. So something like a board that doesn't need to take money from the state general fund but can raise money on its own and function that way is a little bit more safe when you have these economic recessions and things that cause the state general fund to be vastly depleted. So we'll let the GDUC tell you about it, but I'm feeling a lot better now than I did the beginning of the day about whether or not CCB will support that bill. But it's up to them to make their final decision and let you guys know. And one other thing that came out of our conversations this morning was an even stronger renewal of our commitment to each other to talk more, to be in regular, constant communication, and for the Guide Dog Board to talk to GDUC, to talk to CCB, occasionally to GDUI. And also the other consumer organization has its Guide Dog division, CAGDU, which doesn't sound nearly as good as Good Duck. Or maybe it does, but there you go. It must be something about, maybe that's dog talk. Maybe if dogs, it sounds really good to them. Okay, you know, as an administrator of a division within a state agency, I have to, of course, first tell you about the department. In New York, they call it agencies. Here, they call them departments. The control entity that we sit inside of here is the Health and Human Services Agency. So the DOR sits inside of its control agency, which is the Health and Human Services Agency. In New York, the Commission for the Blind, which is where I used to work, sits inside of the Department of Children and Family Services. So you can see how each state kind of organizes its government differently and even calls its entities by different names. So anyways, we sit inside of the Health and Human Services Agency, and any legislators that are interested in what the department is doing are often also interested in other health and human services issues. So, you know, some of the folks that we talk to about DOR stuff are those types of legislators. You know, Frank said something else. He said that there's an effort afoot to find a way to make sure when either laws are changed or regulations are being rewritten, that there's an accessible way for blind people to actually get at that information. You know, what is the old way that it was written? What are the recommended changes so that you can easily tell one from the other and not have to struggle with different, you know, colors of the font and italics and all that stuff. And I just wanted to let you know that one of the programs that I supervise is our BEP, our Randolph Shepherd program, and we've been going for the last year and a half to 2 years now, 2 years really, more than that. We've been undergoing a massive regulation revision process. Huge number of regulations that hadn't been touched since 1992 have been reviewed with our BEP vendor stakeholders, with our staff, with other experts, and revised. And in the middle of all that, our staff attorneys figured out a way to make those changes easy for you, for the you screen reader users especially, to see the changes. And I've got a note here to share the method that we are using. That I think our vendors who use screen reading software feel is really working. It's working about as good as anything is going to, in my opinion. So how we can make it easier for screen reader users to see these types of changes that when you're making a revision in some kind of a document. So we've got a methodology that we've worked out. Our attorneys worked with us to figure out how to do it in response to the vendors saying, hey, my God, this is like really hard. We cannot figure this stuff out without you helping us. And so we worked out a method. I'll share that with Frank. Brief mention about leadership. I think that presentation earlier was really great. I am very interested in the notion of leadership, having been thrust into the position myself, and also knowing about the needs for us to bring along the people who will succeed us, which is, I think it was Lisa that said the words are succession planning. That is the correct term, succession planning. And the thing that I want to impart to all of you is our experience when we're looking for people who want to move up the ladder in various jobs within DOR, it has not been really not a very successful effort at getting some of the visually impaired and blind folks who are working for us to strive for promotions. There are some that have, and they have gotten jobs. Your own Nellie Emerson is the latest example of somebody who got promoted. And Nellie is a rehab is a supervisor now. She supervises rehab counselors. Our blind field services unit's program manager, Kathy Bales, is visually impaired, as am I. And we have a smattering of others who are visually impaired in leadership positions, both in the blindness services and in DOR as a whole. Jerry Awakawa is a supervisor. Darn good one too. Mike Cole, of course, the administrator of OCB, is blind. And our Title VII, our older blind program, Joe Smith, is blind as well. So, I mean, it's not like we don't have visually impaired people. One of my fellow deputy directors, our external affairs deputy director in DOR, a fellow named Joe Xavier, he is blind. So it's not like we don't have them. Our newest legislative analyst, Ralph Black, is blind, and so we have a couple, three blind people sitting at the leadership table now every week when we have our leadership team meeting. So we are making a difference, by the way. So it's good to encourage anybody that you know who is visually impaired, who is in a position to seek a leadership role, doing things with this organization, taking on the chairpersonship of a committee or leading a task force or even emceeing an event, as we heard before. Fantastic stuff to be doing. To start to hone your leadership skills and to start to not be afraid to throw yourself into those roles. And you know, you might think, well, this is a God, you know, this is a thankless job. And sometimes it is, but very often it's very thankful. And you can't know that until you actually throw yourself into it and work your way through your growing pains. Oh, you know, somebody whispered in my ear before when we were talking about marketing CCB and all that stuff, that you might want to think about using some of those social networking tools out there like Facebook, YouTube, MySpace. I just wrote down what she told me. I don't even know what I'm saying right now. So just wanted to throw that idea out there to you. And then on the presentation on retinitis pigmentosa, and then I'll finally get to why I'm actually here to talk to you. The one on the fire. Foundation Fighting Blindness. I had a personal reaction to something I heard, and I just wanted to tell you it. I have RP. I have the classic recessive form of RP, which basically means you're born pretty visually impaired, but you got some good usable vision straight ahead. And then as time goes by, that vision, the quality of that vision deteriorates until you get to a place like I am right now, which is like just barely some light perception. But what struck me was the degree of vision restoration that the presenter's father right now has because he's participating in a study. That sounds just like the place where I was at on my way down through toward light perception from better eyesight through to the eyesight that fellow has down to the light perception. So I wondered to myself, what would it be like to go back up in the other direction? You know, and I'm not sure. This is like, I can visualize still. I have a good visual memory thank goodness, because it helps me. I mean, should I ever have an opportunity to have some vision restored, I'd have to first of all wrestle with the whole thing. I want you to know this is not a simple thing, and I understand all of the philosophical and personal and psychological nuances to the decision to even try to improve your vision, and social and disability identity nuances. So you have to think about these kind of things, but I wonder what it would be like to go back in the other direction, kind of like reversing the tape, and you know, like it's talking backward now, and I'm seeing the way I did, you know, 10 years ago, and I'm not sure. Not sure what I would do. I might be greedy, and so I'm holding out for something a little more than that. So, let's see, man. Okay, I want to bring greetings from the other fella who was supposed to be here today, Tony Sauer, who is my director. Tony has a shoulder injury. He's a person who is paraplegic. He has no movement from the waist on down. So he uses, he's a big, strong guy, by the way. I walk with him a lot, put my hand on his shoulder, because he has one of these wheelchairs that doesn't have handles on the back for you to hang on to, because it's one of these things that he just pushes the wheels by himself. It's not, so he's got big, powerful arms and shoulders. Makes me jealous, actually. Man, I wish I never was like that. Forget it. But you know what's happening as time goes on, and I've heard this, he's told me this, and others have told me this, you do enough of that kind of stuff, and you eventually have shoulder injuries. And so then I see him come in with his power wheelchair, and I'm going, uh-oh, shoulder hurts again, huh? He goes, yeah. And so he's nursing. His shoulder's really, really hurting him right now. So he was worried he might not be able to make it all week long. So I've got his talking points, and I'm going to deliver them now. Greetings from Tony Sauer. Sorry he couldn't be here. He's the director of DOR. Follows a tradition of recently hired directors that really started with Ed Roberts back, I think, in the 1970s. And Ed Roberts is kind of the founder of the independent living movement and a quadriplegic himself, no upper or lower body movement. And Ed really was a major force in the disability rights movement back then, and won a lot of rights for people with disabilities. He was a student at UC Berkeley and founded the first independent living center in the United States, and then eventually became the director of DOR. And the tradition from then on to the present is very often to hire directors who come from either an independent living or disability rights movement or some aspect of disability that is not straightforward vocational rehabilitation. And I have never been told this, so it's just me talking now. I believe the reason for doing that is because the vocational rehabilitation machine can kind of run on its own. And sometimes it does bad things. A lot of times it does wonderful, good things. Sometimes it does bad things. So we try to have a person at the top who doesn't come from that direct mindset, can understand it well, can obviously lead an organization whose primary mission it is to provide VR services, but who has a slightly different angle at things. And that person who in that powerful position can serve as a foil for sometimes when the machine decides it's going to run on its own. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit more in a minute when I talk about my division and specialized services of what that means when the big machine runs on its own. As long as my boss isn't here, I'm going to be daring. Now, I got staff members in the room who, if I find out he learns anything, you're fired. All right. You know, like I can fire anybody. It's civil service. Remember that? All right, Tony would have talked to you about the stimulus package coming from the federal government. You've all heard about the American blah, 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 and Recovery Act, ARRA. And that's the law that's pumping all these trillions of dollars into the economy. And the state voc rehab system in California, DOR, has got $56 million coming to it. I think the money was officially transmitted and made available to us. The permission to use the money was officially received a few days ago. It's good news, yes. We got a bunch of state bureau. We got federal and state bureaucratic things you actually have to do to actually start to spend the money. But even before we actually start to spend the money, we still have to get a whole bunch of concepts that are up on the board, fully vetted and pumped upstairs so that they can get the clearance from the Department of Finance and the governor and other things upstairs where you have to get the clearance. But the goal is to spend the money fast, not to bog it down in bureaucracy. The idea is to get this money out into the economy now. The idea is to help stimulate the economy. The idea is to get more jobs for people. In our case, of course, we want to focus upon people with visual impairments and people with disabilities in general, but just creating jobs out there. Pump money into the private sector. We have some internal infrastructure improvements that are badly needed. 6 months ago when I was here, I had a question from one of my counselors who asked the question about, when are we going to fix our computer system so I don't have to wait like forever every time I try to do a task because the transmission speeds are so slow? And I answered, that's part of a major infrastructure change problem that gets fixed through technology and software, and the only thing that we need is money. Well, looky, we have a few dollars coming our way. And the counselors are going to have, and I think that one's going to pass muster. The counselors are going to eventually have two things. One, computer speeds that they won't know what to do with. It'll be so fast. And number two, eventually they're going to have an information processing system that's going to be so much more user-friendly than the one they have right now, which dates all the way back really conceptually to the 1980s. A brand new information processing system to process all their case notes and when they go to make an authorization to buy something for a consumer and all that stuff that they do every day to actually function with their cases. So, within the next 3 years, their computing system will have been completely revolutionized. We got stuff in the stimulus package, concepts for the blind specifically. improvement projects for OCB, our BEP program, projects that go out to the private agencies for the blind, projects for our older individuals who are blind program, our Title VII Chapter 2 program. So that every one of my units, projects for my other unit that I don't talk about in these circles, my deaf and hard of hearing services unit, projects for them too. So, you know, if all the stuff passes muster, gets through the process and everything like that, I think we're going to have some nice things happening with the stimulus money. The only other proviso, don't use this money if it's going to create either a dependency on this money that we won't be able to do anything about, because the money will run out. It's only for a limited period of time. So whatever you do with this money, it needs to be self-sustaining, or it needs to be so much a one-shot deal, like buying the new computer system, let's say. You know, you buy the computer system and then you have it, and then your normal maintenance is your normal maintenance. You'd be doing that no matter what. So that's okay. You could do something like that. But don't do something where once the money runs out, whatever you started just plain dies because there's no more money. It's not really the way they want us to spend the money. Tony Sauer wanted me to also say something else to you, which is that DOR, as big a machine as it is really, really trying to find ways to be in closer contact with its stakeholders, namely you, the people, our contractors, other stakeholders out there, so that when we either are trying to solve a problem or have an opportunity to do something like how do you spend all the stimulus money, we have a better mechanism that we can routinely use all the time to get true communications. Sometimes what we do is we put out a survey and we say, you know, fill in these three questions and get it back to us in 3 days. And although it is a way for people to, you know, give their thoughts a little bit, it isn't really that great a way. And it gets people really angry at us because they only gave us 3 days to think of something that probably we need a few weeks to think about. And by the way, why don't you dialogue with us anyway? Just talk to us. So he wanted to me to tell you that we are working on ways to do that. I just wanted, you know, one of my favorite hobbies is thinking about working out. Let's just to make sure you're awake. You know, I'm the Deputy Director for Specialized Services. Stuart Wittenstein, before I was talking about history, I want to remind you about some history. There's an organization called BARC, B-A-R-C, Blind Alliance for Rehabilitation Change. Came into existence in the very early 2000s, officially went out of existence on July 1st of 2005 when the law that created my division took effect, which was known as SB 105 back in those days. Now it's part of the Welfare and Institutions Code. And so they went through a 5 or so year effort to, first they thought they were going to get a separate commission for the blind here in California, but when you could see very early on that there was no way the legislature was going to create more government, they compromised in effect on a division for specialized services, blind and deaf, within the DOR. And it created a deputy director position at the top, which is the position I occupy now. And it created a line of authority. So the rehab counselors report, they report directly to me, but they go through their supervisors and through our program manager, Kathy Bales, on their way to me. But there's a direct line of authority. And those were like the two major things that they wanted. But they really wanted was they wanted a way to preserve specialized services. So it's now time for the third biennial report to the legislature on how is this division doing, and I've just completed the draft, and it was approved internally. It's going to go up the line, and when it gets clear of every place up the line it has to go, it gets to the state legislature, and then I can finally share it with all you. The division is, for the most part, the division is hanging in there. It's doing, for DOR purposes, it's doing what it's supposed to do. It's helping to increase employment outcomes. It's not losing ground, even in these hard times. And I think running the stand still doesn't sound very impressive, but if you have actually managed to not lose when everybody else is around you, I think that you have to at least take note of that. It's the power of the division, the progress we've made, that at least helps us to not lose ground. Services to blind people, mostly they're provided from our OCB, and they're provided, the main thing, of course, is our Blind Field Services Unit, have fared relatively well under the budget cuts that we've all been under. Our Blind Field Services Unit got a fair distribution of money. We always hear about things like somebody trying to save money and giving some consumer a hard time about this or that. That we always have. I don't know that we've had a great increase in that. Maybe a little bit more fastidiousness on the part of counselors because their manager tells them we must stay within budget, and I tell her that we must stay within budget. And so we have to do some degree of saving of money so that we make it to the end of the fiscal year. But for the most part, I think we fared well. The Orientation Center for the Blind, which we operate, a residential training center in Albany, we have a curriculum modernization project going on right now. We're looking to we're actually reallocating a little bit of reallocating of staff, changing the supervisory structure a little bit. We have also worked on a I had a staff member, a manager assigned to me temporarily, and he just retired, but I'm hiring him back part-time, and he's going to finish a project on the OCB consumer rights document that we've been working on for a couple of years now, and also just the protocols and procedures that we use when we provide service to people at OCB. And if we get some stimulus money, we're looking to do some architectural modifications to make it even a more functional space there. So if we have any special training programs, maybe weekend training programs, that kind of thing, we'll actually have some space to put these people and use that campus and make better and more use of the campus during times of the week, like in the evenings or on weekends, things like that, where it kind of shuts down. I'm going to hurry up. Our older individuals who are blind program, we call it our Title VII program. That's the one where we contract out $3.25 million to agencies for the blind around the state, and they provide service, independent living training services to people of age 55 or older who are blind or visually impaired. And despite the fact that the funding level has stayed the same for the last 3 years, every year those private agencies somehow managed to serve even more people. So 3 years ago was 2 years ago was 4,000. Last year was something like 4,300, and this past fiscal year that just ended last September 30th, federal fiscal year, it was up to 4,600. They just keep serving more and more people. And what's going on there is the private sector is reaching out to its own resources. Now that those resources are really diminishing for everybody, private sector and public sector, I fear we're going to have a drop-off next year. But we have some stimulus money, and we're looking to pump some of that in there, too, if we can get those projects approved. I got two advisory groups, three. OCB has an advisory group. Blind Field Services has one called the BAC. And my deafness unit has an advisory group, too. So we get some input from there. I think I'm done. You know, the only other issue on the table right now is one that has to do with assistive technology. And really what that's about is, what is the DOR's responsibility? What is my unit's responsibility with regard to quality of service? But yet at the same time, what is our responsibility to the private, not-for-profit sector? If we can have all of that together at the same time, quality service, from the private not-for-profit sector. That's wonderful. But the big issue on the table right now is what happens if in certain parts of the state we don't have that, and what is our role? What do we do? And so it's an issue. I'm calling a conclave of interested parties. I've begun reaching out to them and seeing if they think this conversation is worth having. And so this is kind of a bureaucratic issue. It sounds like it, but really how it touches all of you is, where does your counselor decide to send you to get assistive technology training? And where do they send you? And who's the best one for you? And what resources do we have at our disposal to do that? So next time we talk, 6 months from now, maybe I'll have something more to tell you about that. Now I'm going to end and just open up for some questions and answers.
Okay, questions.
Hello. I was just wondering, what's the policy on like updating technology if someone's had like a 10-year-old Braille note or something like that? Because I have a 10-year-old Braille note, and I got told my counselor can't update it because I'm not currently working or going to school. I think that it still should be updated, though, because it's really old, and I cannot use it anymore. There's no more parallel port printers. Mm-hmm. I can't put flashcards into it because it's an outdated flashcard. I don't have a wireless network. I mean, well, that's not really relevant, but I mean, still.
Let us know, too, who you are and where you're from.
Oh, I'm Julia Sizemore, and I'm from Hayward.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Julia, the question is our policy on upgrading equipment, technology that we have purchased for one of our consumers that has gotten old or outdated.
Yeah.
That's the question. Yeah, I'm repeating it for the microphone. The basic thing that the counselor has said goes to the issue of our reason why we do and why we can provide technology to begin with. And so it is a little bit difficult when the person is not actually engaged in some part of fulfilling a plan. And so everything that we do goes toward fulfilling the individualized plan for employment. And that's the plan that we write down with you. And so it's a tough one. The issue is, if your counselor has told you something and you don't agree with it, to contact the supervisor. And if that doesn't seem to be working for you, or you're not getting satisfaction, to contact the Catherine Bales, the program manager in Sacramento. So without being able to talk about the specific details. The issue is we are allowed to buy technology, including upgraded technology, for people who are actually in plan and doing something toward fulfillment of that plan. So if you're in one of those holding patterns right now or not currently a client of the DOR, it gets to be tougher. But your appeals process is through the supervisor and through Kathy Bales.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Ken Metz, you're recognized.
Okay, thank you. Tony, something that will hopefully relieve you a little bit here. I'm involved with a group called Inspiration. I mentioned it Thursday night at the board meeting, but I'll say it again because this may help someone like her, and I'm not sure. It's an organization that is starting up in Southern Cal, but they want to go eventually throughout the country. So anyone that would like an application for adaptive equipment, they can email me or call me. They can get the number from the CCB office, and we are going to be able to help some folks get equipment. They'll have to demonstrate, you know, the reason that they need it and some of their things as far as qualification in regards to their financial situation. But there is the new group starting, and we're happy to get applications and try and see how many we can help with it.
Okay, thank you, Ken. Jerry Arakawa.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for the presentation.
Let me. I actually am stepping up to make a comment about something that's going to be happening in the department. But let me ask a quick question to the audience. How many of you who are clients of the rehabilitation department have been told we cannot get equipment for you because we're in the middle of getting competitive bids? It may take a long time to get something, but we're working as fast as possible. Well, this is an issue that has dogged a number of counselors, and the whole competitive bid process was an attempt by the state to make purchasing of equipment more fair, less subject to favoritism. What it did, in my editorial opinion, was just create more of a nightmare because it's just such a slow process. Mm-hmm. Well, luckily, the department is moving ahead and implementing a pilot program, and I think Tony alluded to it just briefly. What's going to be happening is the department is moving to transfer folks, to designate people whose sole job is to do competitive bidding proposals. Presumably, and I'm sure some of this stuff is still being worked out, folks in the districts, in the local districts, are going to be receiving training on how to implement this process. But the idea is that counselors will no longer have to do the tedious work in getting competitive bids. They just put out the proposals. They put out the authorization requests for goods, and designated people in the district will have the sole job of looking at fair and reasonable prices, looking at the best vendors with the lowest bids, or in some cases deciding whether vendors who might be faster, more efficient, and more reliable be given the bid even though the price is higher. This will, again, take a lot of that pressure out of the counselor, and hopefully I'm looking forward as a supervisor to get things purchased more quickly. I wondered if you have any comment on that.
I'm just hoping that with the pilot project, by the way, was declared a success, and we're going statewide with a new way of making sure we speed up the procurement process. And I suspect that some of the things that maybe haven't worked quite as fast as we thought of in the pilot project are being worked on right now as well. But it's now declared successful. We're gonna, you know, the specialists that will just do nothing but procurement are supposedly there to work their way through this bureaucracy and shortcut things like, well, we need to get bids all the time. Well, if somebody has gotten bids recently, that's current enough information. You know, we don't. But now the left hand is going to know what the right hand is doing. So somebody in San Diego just got all these bids, although maybe sometimes the people we're buying them from might be different, so you might have to get new bids. But after just a few times, we've probably gotten all the bids we need for a while until maybe there's a reason to think the prices have changed. So little things like that. So I guess my main comment is we're going to go forward with the statewide implementation of these ways of speeding up the process and hope that they work.
Okay, last question, and then if we have time, I might even ask one. David Jackson.
Hello, Tony. Being an alumnus of OCB and trying to be a good advocate for OCB, I'm wondering, the stimulus money that's coming into the state, what do you see, or where do you think this money is this money going to help OCB in any particular way? You talked about changing some of the curricula and moving some of the staff. Can you be a little more specific and give us an idea of perhaps where this money may go? Thanks.
Sure. Improvements to OCB, changes. Just our regular way of operating is what we're doing with regard to staff. Changing the staff configuration a little bit, not a lot. And also the curriculum modernization project, purchase of some new teaching materials. I think we just got several thousand dollars worth of
of teaching materials for our assistive technology and other technology people that we've been trying to order for like a year and a half. So even our staff gets caught up in the procurement process. No, the stimulus money, if we get it, the stimulus money will go through to our big wish list, which is some architectural changes, some renovations, windows that haven't been replaced in 40 years. We have a project already underway. It's already funded, and it's been something we've been working on for at least 2 years to replace the three boilers, three buildings, three boilers, vintage 1966 boilers. Thank God it doesn't get like freezing cold in the Berkeley Albany area. The stimulus money, if we get it, would go toward things like reconfiguring some of the rooms in the dormitories, increasing our dormitory capability, changing some of the conferencing space, manipulating some of the classroom space, making a kitchen, a training kitchen that for the first time ever we will actually do something that a fellow from one of the other organizations keeps pounding on me. For heaven's sake, those consumers ought to be doing a lot more of their own cooking. So, you know, we have a space problem. Changing so a lot of these modifications I see, you always wonder, well, why the heck, you know, we keep asking them to do this and do that and they don't do it. Finally getting down to actually looking at these things from a functional perspective instead of blaming people. I generally think that people most of the time are about the same wherever you go. Yeah, you get some people a little bit more aggressive about making change and other people who are a little less aggressive. 9 times out of 10, the issue isn't about them. It's about the environment that they're sitting inside of and that surrounds them. And so we have to look at why things don't happen very often from a systems perspective and from a physical environmental perspective. And I decided finally that a lot of the changes that weren't happening that we would like to have happen that just never did had to do with the physical environment being 40-something years old. So some of the stimulus money, if we get it, is going to go toward changing the physical environment. And we already have projects underway regarding staffing and curriculum modernization.
Lorraine Brown, you'll be the last question. We're a little after 4 o'clock. Lorraine Foster, sorry.
Thank you.
Oh, and then our president will have a quick one.
Okay, I'm Lorraine Foster from San Diego Chapter, and I just wanted to make a comment that what you've heard about DOR really worked. They tried to close my case as a homemaker, and I've already raised my 6 kids. So I was able to convince that my dog did not need raising, and that what they needed was a position that I went back to school for, and they said they had no position like that, no pay scale for that position. So I just told them it was negotiable, and so I now am an ISP for DOR in working as a diabetic nutritionist, a consultant for their clients.
Fantastic. Incredible. Jeff, I'm going to
pass. Yes, okay. No, I've got one.
Oh, you got one. Good, okay.
One of the things that's a little disconcerting, but maybe not, is that there's really little information out there, at least to many of us, about the processes and the manner in which it will be determined as to how the stimulus package funding will be utilized. Just wondering, as one prong of that, you know, one way in which to promote employment is to give, you know, little mini grants to entities like community-based organizations such as ourselves that can do more with 15 or 20,000 sometimes than the department can do with 150,000. And so I'm wondering, will there be potentially a portion of money for grants to private agencies, you know, not necessarily huge grants, but small ones, and how do we even participate in the processes to get involved in these decisions?
I mean, it's a great question because it gives me a chance to talk about two different things. What we haven't been doing up until now, three things. What we've learned in the last few weeks, and just last week, and what we're planning to do in the very, very near future. So what we didn't think we could do up until a few days ago was put money out directly for the hiring. Like, in other words, put money out and say, here, this will cover a salary. We didn't think that that was what the feds would say would be allowable. So we took ideas that we have received along those lines, and we put them into the box and rank ordered the and now I'm answering a little bit the question, but what is the process? Right? And we rank ordered the concepts on the basis of those guidelines we already had and what we think were feasible to accomplish, and what would do the greatest good. And then finally, we got some guidance from our federal control agency just the other day, Rehab Services Administration. I have begun to disseminate that guidance. This is a public document, so that everybody can see what it is that we're being told. And we think that there may be they may be more open to us actually pumping money into direct salaries for certain positions, and so we're looking into it now because we think that they are encouraging us to do some of that. So Jeff, as of just a couple of days ago, I went from thinking no, we couldn't do it, to maybe now yes, we might be able to do it. The process for the future will differ from what we've done up until now, which is up until now we've basically done a lot of staff brainstorming and a little bit of kind of like one-way dialogue, as it were, with the stakeholders. Why don't you send in some ideas to us, and we'll put them into the hopper.
I've sent one in, and I'll resend it.
Yes, I have yours. I have yours, Jeff. Okay. I know what it's for, too. But you know what? Resend it anyways.
All right.
So in the future, though, in the near future, we're opening up. We now have gotten to a point where we had to send up to our own state finance people our basic ideas. And we had to account for the spending of all $56 million to the VR program, and all the money for our OIB program. It's a separate pot of stimulus money for our older individuals who are blind program. And we had to send all that stuff up. But we sent it up in very broad ways to say, you know, some of the stuff are going to be projects to improve the functioning of private sector partners out there, to be actually divvied out through like a grant process of sorts, where we say send your ideas to us, and just like you do when it's a grant process, we'll pick the ones that are the most promising and make our awards that way. So now it opens the door for us to get all sorts of new ideas and maybe a bunch of repeat ideas, and take the ones that we have that we didn't think we could do, and maybe see if we can't now mold them in to the broad concepts that we've put up to our finance department. And so this is a very technical way of saying we're going to open up the door to more dialogue. I'm setting up meetings already to sit down and talk, and not just do it one way, but do a two-way kind of conversation with whoever out there has interest in this. And we're holding some public forums. And at those public forums, there will be an opportunity to comment on a couple of things that we need the public to comment on. And now we have added in a third thing into the public forums, namely, give us your ideas about how you want us to spend the stimulus money. So those public forums are being announced even as we speak. They're going out through I don't know what mechanisms. I'm sending them out through all of my connections, and they're going up on the website. So between our private dialogues, my meetings that I'm holding, and then the public forums, we're trying to open up the door to these ideas. See, April 27 is Sacramento. April 29 is Oakland at the state office building. Our central office building at 721 Capitol Mall. The 29th is at the state office building in Oakland, where Oakland DOR is located. I think it's 1515 Clay. The Elihu State Office Building, Elihu Harris State Office Building. Then down in Southern California, we got one in Irvine. I think it's May 5th, I think it is. And then that would be a Friday, whatever that Friday is. And then the following Monday is the last one. It's in Fresno.
And that's May 11th.
May 11 is the last one. 10, 9, 8. So May 8th must be the Friday for the one in Irvine. The
Tony
announcement's out there. Yes,
Tony Candela, thank you very much. And
thank you.
I won't ask you my question, but if you're still around when we're done, I'll catch you.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Chris Gray, your treasurer in CCB. It's been a pleasure to moderate this afternoon. We're now in recess until tomorrow morning. Thank you all very much.